debt, war, corruption, treason, and an open season on human rights. Tears at the fabric of our nation, and the tragic realization is that future generations will pay the big price. Wake up and shake it up, America, from north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea. Our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. This land is your land.
This land is my land.
If we come together and work together, we can pull the weeds that threaten to destroy our land. I hope and pray you understand we cannot reap a good harvest with a bunch of bad seeds. Wake up and shake it up, America, from north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea. Our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. Abraham Lincoln proclaimed, "We are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations." He also observed, "You can fool all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time."
Wake up, shake it up, America.
Our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore them. America, north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea. Our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. Wake up and shake it up, America.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Taking Back America, the official show of Take Back America for the People. We are a 501c3 nonprofit whose mission is to educate Americans and people around the world about the costs of allowing corporate control of the U.S. government. Today we're going to be talking about something that's in the headlines, and that is Russia's moves in Syria, which are being characterized in the U.S. media as some sort of aggression. Well, a lot of people who read something besides the New York Times have a different take on that. And one of them is our guest today, Carl Eisenbach, who's been on the show many times. He's a blogger at opensalon.com. He writes under Old New Lefty, so you can check that out if you want to find out more about his thoughts on this and other things political. Anyway, Carl and I are going to be talking about exactly what Russia's situation is. I think we really need to understand what the protagonists in any conflict, what the situation they're in, if we want to understand who's lying. And, of course, following the money doesn't hurt either when you're trying to figure out who's lying. I think Carl's going to make the case today that people in the U.S. and in the West in general are being lied to. We've talked about the way the media is manipulated many, many times by the CIA and the people that control it. So, and Carl also happens to be a self-taught expert on the CIA. So, Carl, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be here.
Well, I really appreciate your calling me and suggesting this topic for a show. I hadn't thought about it, but you're right. It's critically important with what's going on right now. Can we we're going to do a whole overview of how this all fits, but why don't we start with what I just said, which is Russia now sending military supplies to Syria in open defiance of U.S. dictates. Telling them they can't do that. And the New York Times calls this naked aggression.
The short answer is it's pretty ridiculous for a couple of reasons. One of which is that militarily, the United States has never had any military presence in Syria that I know of. Number two, you know, people in the United States don't realize that a long-established Russian naval base exists in Tarsus in Syria. So it's like, you know, well, it'd be like one of our major overseas bases, like, say, in the Philippines or you know, somewhere in a NATO country, you know. And so Russia has always had a presence in Syria. And you know, we can go back and forth about blaming, you know, who's responsible for the events going on over there in Syria beyond the Assad government. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, I think that there's more than enough blame for everybody. And what we have going on with the so-called controversy in Syria is basically boils down to more than anything good old-fashioned American imperialism.
Okay, and I would just add one thing to that, and that is that, yes, Russia has a military base there, which is similar to U.S. military bases. The biggest and quite enormous difference is that Russia doesn't have very many military bases around the world, whereas the U.S. has them all over the world.
Exactly.
And so that makes it just that much more important to Russia, especially when the U.S. just tried to take over their military base in Crimea, historically Russian territory. You want to talk about
right.
how that connects to this?
Yeah, and you know, one of the things, you know, first give me a little time to give my rant about the biases of Western journalism. The establishment press, both in Europe and the United States, and going into Canada, because, I mean, the Harper government is sort of a puppet government of us, is all uniformly against the Russians and the horrible aggression that Russia has committed in the Ukraine and the horrible aggression that Russia wants to commit in Syria. And it's all bogus, 100%. The other thing that the press misses in terms of the press coverage that we're spoon-fed every day in foreign affairs is that there is a huge link between the situation in Ukraine and in Syria. And both in Ukraine and in Syria, you have the overreach of the American empire and its allies and basically not being able to control things maybe the way they used to when we were the entire ruler of the world. That all the ruler of the world thing is slipping beyond our grasp, and we're beginning to experience failures in our policy, both in Ukraine and in Syria, because we are no longer capable of dominating the entire world. Our empire is slipping. And so Russia has key strategic interests in both Syria and Ukraine that it appears to be beyond the grasp of the policymakers in Washington, D.C. to understand. The Washington, D.C. policymakers are sort of trapped in their old imperial mindset. And at this point in time, the people in D.C. running the show are totally guilty of obsolete thinking.
Mm-hmm. I would say that I know what you mean by old imperialist mindset, because this goes back as far as the War of 1812. At least when one of the main motivations for invading Canada was to try to make it part of the brand new United States. But I would say there's been a change in imperialist thinking, too. You know, there was a time when it was perfectly acceptable to use naked aggression, like the Spanish-American War, to seize territory because everybody else did it. Well, supposedly that time is over. Colonialism is dead, supposedly. We have a new form of colonialism called neocolonialism, where we dictate to other countries economically. But the fact of the matter is, there are some countries that have always held out. The U.S. has never controlled the whole world. They've never really controlled Russia, although they had a lot of power right after the fall of the wall when it was weak and disorganized. They never controlled China. They never controlled Venezuela since the Chavez Revolution. They never controlled Iran, I mean, since the fall of the Shah, and on and on. The fact of the matter is, there is an axis of resistance. And this, I think, is the key point here. There's an axis of resistance against the advance of empire, and I think you're right. I think they're turning the tide right now, but we're not reading about it in the corporate media. And that's why what you have to say today is so important. So anyway, let's go on from there. So you said Rush is being demonized. When do you think that started?
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is that from a geopolitical standpoint, okay, the larger context of global politics, there's always been a certain amount of tension between the United States and Russia because they're two supercontinental superpowers in their own with huge, you know, resources, and it's only natural that there should be potentials for conflict between two giants like this in terms of land area alone. Given that, though, okay, you know, if you operate in the balance of power theory and you say, well, okay, some areas of the world are obviously going to be much more under Russian control, and some areas of the world are going to be obviously much more under the control or influence of the United States. And if you don't understand the limitations of those areas of control and the converse, where we have no control whatsoever, okay, there people in Washington, D.C. Appear to have the illusion that somehow we could control, you know, the situation in Ukraine, that we can somehow dictate to the Russians the manner in which they should be establishing relations with the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
This is like a patently ridiculous argument. Let's stand it on its head and look at the United States' relationship with Canada, all right? And if the Russians suddenly wanted to make Canada part of the Warsaw Pact, you know, and they had installed a communist government in Canada. I mean, what would the United States reaction be in this? I mean, we'd be on the road probably to World War III, wouldn't we? You know,
well,
yet,
isn't that pretty much the definition of American exceptionalism, this kind of double standard you're describing?
Well, you know, American exceptionalism is basically just a fig leaf for the imperatives of empire, as far as I'm concerned. You know, I mean, the old communist system, you know, in the Soviet Union said, well, okay, the ideology of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union was, you know, we want to bring communism to the whole world. The ideology of the American government is we want to bring democracy and freedom to the whole world. Well, what does that mean? Basically, what it means is that the United States wants to have puppets for every place in the world that everybody thinks exactly like the way we do. Well, you know, that's not going to work. And so, you know, yet you've got these people with the ideology, and of course the ideology is tied intimately to the money, okay, in terms of the demands for controlling markets and everything else like that. And the fact of the matter remains is that, you know, Russia, let's looking at the Ukraine. Russia has 1,000 years of intertwined history with the region of Ukraine, the country of Ukraine. So that's basically five times longer and five times deeper than any relationship we have as the United States with Canada. And so it's like, how would it be possible for the United States to interfere with a relationship like that? You know, it's basically, I mean, that's what we're trying to do, and it's patently ridiculous. The same thing goes with Syria. You know, Syria is another one of those countries that has, I'm thinking probably about a 6,000 or 7,000 year history, okay? And not one day out of Syrian history has there ever been an American-style democracy in that country. And yet we're defending the freedom and the democratic urges of the citizens of Syria. You know, you go, tell me how that works. You have the ideology that sort of drives the American policy machine into establishing a totally unrealistic picture of what the way things are and a totally unrealistic set of demands in terms of the way the Syrian people should be conducting themselves. And then we double that down by saying, bad Russia, you're interfering with the democratic process or whatever reason we're having for getting our fingers caught in the ringer, you know, in terms of what the Russians are trying to do in Syria. It's all ridiculous.
Well, let's go back to my original question. Let me just clarify what I meant. When I said, how long has this been going on? You kind of touched on it before you got to other points. Basically, I think if I understood you correctly, you said because Russia has so much landmass and the resources to go with that, that this has been going on basically forever, for the whole history of empires. And I would say it's my impression, and tell me if you agree, that Russia has never been invited to somehow make an alliance, an accommodation with the other imperial powers, the U.S., Britain. In fact, Britain made war on them when they were an empire. The imperialists have never been serious about making Russia a partner in what you might call a new world order, where we could possibly live in peace. Kennedy tried that, and Kennedy got killed for his trouble. But when did this? I think there was a change again. I think that the people in Washington haven't always thought they could take over the whole world. I think there was a time when they recognized the limits of power, talked about a balance of power, used a policy of containment against the USSR, which was a much more dangerous enemy than Russia, because it really was more aggressive and more repressive and more ambitious than Russia is. But now we're being told Russia is trying to become an empire, and that Putin is personally responsible, but we're supposed to punish the whole country because of that.
Right.
This is typical.
Right.
So you want to talk about that?
A little historical context, I think, is in order, because, you know, there's really a huge break, you know, in American history before 1945 and after 1945. And obviously the relationship that we had, you know, with the Soviet Union before, you know, up until 1945 was completely different from the relationship after we won the war. In terms of the issue of so-called partnership, you know, with the United States, you know, in 1991, I believe, when the Soviet Union ended, you know, there was a window of opportunity. And, in fact, you know, the American government, under the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, made some promises to the change in government from the Soviet Union to Russia that there'd be more of an equal partner kind of thing. Unfortunately, you know, the way the American foreign policy and economic apparatus is conceived of a relationship with the new country of Russia in the 90s was that somehow, you know, this was a brand new market, number one, that we could take advantage of in terms of selling Pepsi Cola and God knows what to the Russians. But more importantly, you know, there was this sort of thing that, well, now we have the chance to expand and put our system of government in place in Russia, the kind of government that we want. And on top of this, you know, the American government was taking advantage in terms of the Russians by expanding our empire of our NATO alliances all the way up to, you know, Lithuania and Estonia and Latvia, okay? And the plans back in the 90s were that eventually, you know, we would have NATO, would have ally, you know, Ukraine and Georgia would be part of the allies of NATO. Would they be next? And after, you know, Ukraine and Georgia, then Russia would somehow be subsumed into this kind of a NATO, grand NATO alliance, and basically, you know, Russia would then be assimilated by the American mothership at that point.
Yeah, let me just interrupt for a second here, because I think you maybe overstated one point there. It may be true that American imperialists had that in mind all along, but the fact of the matter is that George H.W. Bush made a promise that NATO would not expand its borders one inch eastward from Germany, and Bill Clinton violated that when he added the Baltic countries, and it's just continued to be that way ever since. But I think only crazy people thought they'd add Ukraine, which is historically, but much of it is Russian territory historically. Nikita Khrushchev came from the Crimea, for God's sake.
Right.
So let me just summarize some of what you said and see if I got it straight here. So what you're saying is that America made all these promises, but really what they saw with the fall of the wall was a giant business opportunity. And I would add one thing to that, too. I would say you talked about America wanting puppet governments everywhere. They actually thought they could set up a puppet government in Russia because Yeltsin was weak and he was willing to go. The country was weak at the time. They were very vulnerable. And Yeltsin gave up a lot for a bunch of empty promises. The fact of the matter is that these U.S. imperialists and the bankers behind them made a lot of deals with oligarchs in Russia. This is what they do. They find the privileged people in a country, they prop them up, they make them the rulers either behind the scenes or directly, and then they do everything. The CIA does everything, and USAID and all these other, and the American government in general, does everything they can to prop up these governments until they're no longer viable or they're in the way, like Saddam Hussein got in the way. Of the imperialist.
Right, exactly. Exactly. No, I think you know, that America is really partly responsible for creating the Russia of today. You know, if the Clinton administration had somehow had the cojones, you know, to say, okay, we want a massive aid program to Russia, okay, where we're willing to invest billions and billions of dollars in foreign aid to Russia to help them in this transition period from the Soviet system into a Russian nationalist system. You know, the composition of Russian society today might have been substantially different than it is today. But instead, what we encouraged, you know, was for, you know, crony capitalism to flourish in Russia. And so you have all the creation of the instant billionaires in Russian society. And so Russian society today is what it is, you know, in part because America was unable or unwilling to provide Russia with the kind of aid that would transition it into a different society than what it is today. So instead what we're left with is sort of the reptile brain of much of the American foreign policy establishment goes back to the bad old days, as it were, of the Cold War. And we appear to be in some kind of position of being in Cold War II right now. And let's be perfectly honest about what the basis of Cold War II really is. And what that is basically for the defense contracts. I mean, you know, we made a lot of money. A lot of people got rich at the Soviet threat. And so the idea of reestablishing, you know, Cold War II and painting the Russians as the new evil people is actually extremely good for the American defense business and the oil companies and Wall Street and everybody else. And to me, that's pretty much what it's all about. A lot of the conflicts we've got going are as you say, completely money-driven by the 1% of the United States and Europe.
Well put, Carl, well put. And to put it back in the larger context of geopolitics here, a lot of people are saying, and I've been one of them, that Syria, one of the main goals of taking down Syria isn't just to target Iran, but to destroy Soviet influence in the Mideast Russian influence in the Mideast, because the Russians are next after that, if the neocons were to succeed. Do you subscribe to that theory?
Yeah, oh, absolutely, because, I mean, I think you know, the idea of Russian society has always been sort of like a target for the financiers and the Defense Department analysts and everybody. You know, we there's this desire for some people somewhere in the United States government and Wall Street to we're not going to be happy until we own the whole shebang. And so, you know, somehow there's this need to demonize Russia as the new Soviet Union. And when it comes to Syria, you know, let's not forget that a large part of the problems with Syria were caused by our involvement in this, Iraq and Afghanistan. And when you destabilize an area that's on the Syrian borders, and then you create civil war basically in Iraq, and it spills over into Syria, you know, one of the things that was an unintended consequence, I guess, of our involvement in Iraq is that it totally destroyed the boundaries that were established after World War I in the Treaty of Versailles. You know, Syria as a country, Iraq as a country, you know, Saudi Arabia as a country, all these places, Turkey as a country, all these were formed in 1919 because of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. They drew the lines on the map and said, okay, this is going to be Syria, this is going to be Iraq, blah, 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 blah. And so basically, you know, you had a very stable situation geopolitically, comparatively in the Middle East, well, almost 100 years, you know, and then George Bush goes in with his adventures, you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan, and lo and behold, the entire concept of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, establishing the boundaries of Syria and Turkey and Iraq and everything else like that, have basically been blown to smithereens, okay? And at this point in time, okay, nobody in the world has any idea in terms of the way the destruction of those national boundaries is going to go, what the total consequences of that is. I mean, you know, we're basically looking at a prolonged period of chaos in the Middle East, and that chaos was caused in good part by the Bush-Cheney administration. And this is one of those things the American foreign policy establishment is not willing to own up about, you know. So somehow we have to project onto the Russians, oh, it's those bad Russians getting involved in Syria.
Let me just interject here. You keep saying Bush and the Bush administration. Of course, as president, he was responsible for what happened under his watch. But the truth is that when Bush was selected by the Supreme Court, he brought in a bunch of these neocons who most people considered nuts before that, according to Thomas Ricard, anyway, the author of Fiasco. He's an investigative reporter, did a pretty good job in that book of describing how the Iraq War came down. One of the main points he made was that neocons took over the foreign policy establishment, and they basically imposed this mentality that now is the time to establish a new American century, sort of like the Nazi Third Reich, where one country would take over the world and impose a Pax Americana, and it would be wonderful for everybody because they would be at peace. But the truth is, the most important goal was to put into power, or to crystallize the power of the global elite at the time, and that's exactly what they mean by New World Order, according
right.
to people like Tony Carlucci and stuff. So you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, one of the things I want to add sort of as a digression on this is I think a lot of people have some kind of misunderstanding about the nature of political power in Washington, D.C. You know, there is the assumption that, well, you know, the president is the commander-in-chief and, you know, therefore he has a pretty free rein in terms of what he does in foreign policy. To a large extent, yeah, that's true. Look at what happened in terms of our treaty negotiations with Iran. I mean, Barack Obama basically did get what he wants. The thing is that given the humongous size of the federal bureaucracy and the humongous power of corporate interests in the United States, you know, basically what you have is that a huge amount of foreign policy making actually goes on at the mid-levels of American government and at the upper levels of the private sector, and that they work in tandem with each other. And so, for example, you know, with George Bush and the PNAC, the Project for New American Century, ideologues, okay, basically Bush, you know, gave the PNAC ideologues, you know, free rein to do whatever they want because everybody else was doing free rein in the Bush administration. And they get deep into those little corners of the American foreign policy establishment. And basically what they did at that point in time in this area was to become the tail that was wagging the dog. Then what Bush did when he left office was he went through the process of what is called sheep-dipping these ideologues. And basically they were political appointees, and they suddenly found themselves transformed into bureaucrats with a lifetime tenure. And so the people like Victoria Nuland, for example, who was like one of the people deeply involved with PNAC in the 90s, suddenly becomes a permanent fixture in the American foreign policy consolation. And then lo and behold, she's one of the people who's actually driving our policies in Ukraine. And, you know, Victoria Nuland is only one out of maybe hundreds of people that are sort of like have been, you know, transformed into permanent bureaucrats that actually control this sector of foreign policy, both in Ukraine and Syria. And so the president is, at this point in time, more or less a prisoner of the people in the State Department, the Defense Department, and the CIA, Department of Commerce, and elsewhere, you know, in his own government, that are telling him what to do.
Not to mention the Fed and the Treasury.
Well, that's all part. One hand washes the other, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So what we have here, okay, are a bunch of committed ideologues with this sort of like magical thinking that somehow every country we touch with our imperial power will be able to install a puppet government, and then we can have like either Barack Obama or Bill Clinton to be the president of Syria or Iraq or whatever. I mean, this is as unrealistic an expectation, you know, as the Soviet Union has, saying, well, we'll just have the march of communism and we'll convert the whole damn world into the Soviet system. Well, guess what? It doesn't work. It's like I might as well believe in the Easter Bunny, okay, as in the magic ideology of the neocons. They both have the same basis of rationality.
Well, you know, that's an interesting comparison. Basically what you're talking about is the clash of empires between USSR and post-World War II United States. But there was a big difference. I think the approaches were quite different. U.S. has always had a military bent. The Korean War was provoked by the U.S., which essentially occupied South Korea and made it quite clear their intent was to unify Korea under U.S. control. U.S. still controls the South Korean military. If they go to war, the U.S. is in charge.
They were never
authorized to go there by the UN in the first place, and they're calling UN peacekeeping mission. It never was. That's a lie.
Well, you know, see, Rick, here's where I think you've come to a very key point, okay? And that is the conditions for the United States and the world are substantially different now than they were in 1950. You know, in 1950, you know, two-thirds of the world, the developed world, was bombed out, and they were devastated. We owned half the money and all the money in the world, okay? I mean, basically, in the 1950s, we could do whatever damn well we wanted to in terms of overthrowing the Iranian government or overthrowing the Guatemalan government. Okay, it was almost like the United States was playing the game of Risk. Well, let's control the world. Easy for the United States to do. Well, we found out there were consequences of that, one of those things. But let's look at 2015 in America right now. And let's look at the situation with our society here. And let's look at the bloated military spending that we have. Let's look at the policies of austerity that are being imposed on domestic society. Let's look at how the fact that American people basically are slowly becoming impoverished because of the neocon and policies of, you know, Washington, D.C. The empire is sort of rotting from within, okay? And because our domestic society is slowly decaying, you know, that certainly reflects on our ability to project our imperial power overseas. And yet we are still driven by this magical thinking of Cold War mentality and, oh, my God, we have to do something about the poor Ukrainians living in Crimea, or, oh, my God, we really care so much about the people living in Syria. That's why there's not a change in thinking in terms of the decision makers in Washington, D.C. They're still operating in the old mode. They still basically are unable to conceive that the position of American power overseas today is substantially different, and that America is substantially weaker as an empire today than it was in 1950.
Well, you know, you make a pretty strong argument there, but let me play devil's advocate a little bit and challenge one of your assumptions. It sounds like one of the things you're saying is because the United States is economically much weaker, we ship our jobs overseas, people are becoming impoverished, and we're spending too much on the military, that's diminished our power. I would question that, because the truth of the matter is that the people who profit from war, the puppet masters, I think you called them earlier, the people that look at the world as a gigantic game of risk or monopoly, if you will, or a giant chessboard, as Brzezinski called it, these are the people who are actually benefiting from this. And guess what? They don't care what happens to the people of the United States. They don't even care what happens to the dollar necessarily. I mean, it should be obvious the dollar is headed for collapse. So maybe they see their only choice as to finalize what the neocons have been trying to do all along and take over the world, so that other countries can't take the place of the United States when the dollar collapses. What do you think of that argument?
I think you have an extremely valid point, and I think what you're kind of highlighting is at this point in time, you know, basically there's a serious disconnect, you know, between the policies of the American government as a national entity and the policies being pursued by, for lack of a better term, the 1% or the Fortune 500 or whatever you want to call them. You know, if you look at, you know, what comes out of places like Davos or Bilderberg or whatever, you know, you see a completely different ideology about the way the world should be structured than what you see out of Washington, D.C. You know, the 1% ideology from Davos or Bilderberg says, okay, what's good for a multinational corporations is good for the world. And so the multinationals don't have any problem whatsoever in terms of impoverishing the American society, because what they say, well, okay, we're bringing down the level of standard of living in the United States, and we're destroying the robust society that we used to enjoy in the 50s and the 60s. And so the multinationals are sort of practicing redistribution of income at a global scale. And so you can see, for example, the incredible growth of China, how that, you know, it's not happening right now, but, you know, from 1990 up until today, the annual average growth rate of the Chinese economy was 11%, and that's 11% compounded, okay, on an annual basis. So China has made huge strides. You know, when I visited China in 1978, you know, the average annual income in China was $400 a year. And now, you know, my understanding of the Chinese society is that the average annual income of China is actually close to Mexico, which is $5,000 a year. So, I mean, the standard of living for the Chinese people has gone up basically 11 times since 1990. And I do not think that our American standard of living has gone up 11 times. Why? Because multinational capital realizes that they can maximize their gains. They can create more billionaires, you know, by going into places like China and going into every place in Asia and Africa and South America, you know, and exploiting those resources, giving the natives a few pennies that'll make them increase their standard of living. And meanwhile, you know, the businesses and financial aspects of the rulers of the world, they'll just pile $1 billion or $1 trillion on top of another, and they'll become that more rich and that more powerful. So the interest of, you know, the United States used to be totally aligned 100% with the interests of Wall Street and the Fortune 500. That is no longer the place, no longer the case. I mean, the Fortune 500, the 1%, whatever you call them, their agenda now is completely different from anything that could be called an American agenda.
I think you're right, and I think we need to make a point here that this is not just your conclusion, Carl, or mine, or anybody else's. This was actually, when I say this, I mean the concept that what happens globally is more important than it happens to individuals because it's good for everybody. That concept is sort of like a one world government where corporations are actually have more power than nations, and they actually supersede nations. This is what's meant by global government. And it isn't just our conclusion from watching these free trade agreements and all this other nonsense, shipping our jobs overseas. It's also exactly what David Rockefeller said when he left, I think it was one of the Bilderberg conferences. I could be wrong, but one of those Davos or Bilderberg, G20, whatever. He was walking away from one. He was approached by Alex Jones, of all people, who asked him to his face, "Do you think you have the right to dictate what happens to the rest of the world, to make decisions for all of us?" And Rockefeller's answer was, "Well, who else is going to do it?" That's just
precisely
their assumption that that's how it is,
right?
And that's the way it's supposed
to
be.
And so basically what is happening here is that the United States government now is basically being totally played by the corporate interests. And what that is doing is destroying our domestic society. And it only benefits the ultra elite, you know, to concentrate their wealth and power, who basically want to have one world government of corporatocracy. And if you look at the TPP and the trade agreements and everything else like that, certainly not designed for you or me. We don't get any benefits out of that. So who benefits, you know? And when you transfer that into the way the rich dictate to our foreign policy establishment, you know, the countries of Ukraine and Syria, from the corporatocracy standpoint, are merely cat's paws. Because, you know, I mean, I think, let's be brutally honest, you know, what they're looking for is they're looking for an expansion of their markets and an expansion of their profitability. And the way they can expand their profitability and their markets is by meddling and interfering with Russian society. There's the idea that somehow if, you know, Wall Street can bring Russia to its knees, you know, somehow promote a different ruler than Vladimir Putin, maybe we can install, you know, kind of like a Russian puppet government. And then, you know, basically the Russian people will get with the idea of, you know, Western democracy and freedom, and, you know, everybody will get that much more rich. And I hate to sound cynical, Carl.
Carl, you're right. But let's take this to a human level here. First of all, that never works. You're talking about a collective punishment of a people to motivate them to overthrow their own governments. We're trying it in Russia. We've tried it in Venezuela. We tried it in Iran. And when that doesn't work, as John Perkins said in his book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, if you can't bribe the leaders, if that doesn't work, then you may have to go in and assassinate them. If that doesn't work, then you overthrow the government. And that's what we're seeing now. They're just going straight to Plan C in a lot of cases. But let's go back to Ukraine for a second. I don't want to make this too complicated and get to talking about color revolutions. Let's just talk about these economic punishments, first of all. They are a form of collective punishment. They are not authorized under international law. They're simply something that the most powerful countries decided they could get away with under any pretext.
Right.
And so the Russian people are suffering horribly because of our policies, just like they did after the fall of the Berlin Wall when the U.S. went in and made a bunch of deals with oligarchs who stole all the state's wealth and the people couldn't even get bread. And Americans at some point have to understand that punishing an entire people because your government says they don't like the leaders, when your government is in the control of corporate whatever, the global elite, you have a responsibility to stand up for those people, the people of Russia, the people of Iran, the people of Syria. These are not our enemies just because the government says so. I mean, look who's in the government. People who support free trade agreements. Like you said, there's nothing in it for us. And then when the country goes broke, then they say, oh, we have to watch our budget. Well, geez, they're never watching their budget when they're starting all these wars. It's a lie. It's all lies. And all it does is promote economic inequality, makes the people who really control the country richer and the rest of us poorer, and people are dying all over the world because people in the United States have not stood up yet. And the same goes for European countries, I would say.
Yeah. I have one caveat to what you said, though, Rick. And
sure.
that is that, believe it or not, you know, Russian society is fairly prosperous, and the people of Russia are generally enjoying a fairly good standard of living. You know, when I went over to Russia, you know, and I had a chance to go to the Russian countryside, you know, I felt like I was in rural Oregon. So, I mean, that's the kind of standard of living that Russian society generally has. And the thing about Russia is, you know, it's a country that has 12 time zones. It spans half of the globe, okay? It has more resources probably than any other country in the world. And it uses those resources for the benefits of its people. Now the thing is, okay, the United States sees those resources. We'd love to have those resources, and we'd love to destabilize Putin. But to be realistic, you know, the United States doesn't have a chance of interfering in Russian society the way it might like to do that. So what does the United States and its power-hungry, you know, decision-makers do is they sort of use a cat's paw approach. Okay, Ukraine is vulnerable, so let's put in $5 billion to destabilize, you know, the Ukrainian government under the George Bush administration. And so you have the color revolutions and everything else like that. So that, you know, the Ukrainian government today is faced with dealing with IMF loans, basically, that are more crippling than the loan situation that the IMF and the EU imposed in Greece, all right? And Ukrainian society is really now a very bad place to live in. Well, we don't really care about Ukraine as a country except to cry crocodile tears at Russian aggression.
That is such a good way of putting it, Carl. Let me just go back for a second, a point I made earlier. I just want to clarify, because you're right when you say I shouldn't have compared the Russian standard of living right after the fall of the wall to what it is now. What I meant to say was, because of the fall in oil prices, they're suffering that just like Americans are. Their standard of living is falling. They did have a great standard of a very relatively good standard of living, but it's falling in the cities. Now, you talked about in the countryside, they're still thriving. Well, you know what? In the countryside, people survived even during the Great Depression in the United States because they were self-sufficient. And in Russia, they do still have a thriving, locally owned farms. So they can take care of themselves. They're self-sufficient. And I think that's one reason they're weathering this as well as they are. But they definitely, their standard of living is hurting, but nothing like Ukraine. You are so right about Ukraine. They are hurting so badly. People forget about the changing explanations for the U.S. positions. You know, we said, the government is corrupt. That's the problem. And so the people revolted because they were going to make a corrupt deal with Russia. Well, the truth is, the deal they were going to make with Russia would have brought in $18 billion in guaranteed loans under conditions much less onerous than the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and they would get huge discounts on gas or continue to enjoy huge discounts on gas and even get some of that written off. It was a very sweet deal, and yet the people resisted because, yeah, the government was corrupt even at that. So what did they accept? They accepted a government that was controlled by fascists. I'm not saying everybody was fascist, but the ones in the key positions were fascists. They were the ones who were on the square shooting at both police and protesters while Victoria Nuland was passing out cookies. People just can't put two and two together, because if they assume that the U.S. government means well but just kind of screws up a hell of a lot, then they don't see that this is all part of a systematic plot to take over the world. And the neocons are insane, and they've driven.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think that you know that's a very valid point. You know, the at one point in time, you know, Putin offered to share the responsibility of economic support with the European Union regarding financial injections into Ukraine. And the EU and the American government rejected that through the puppet Ukrainian government. And so, you know, there's a fundamental problem that the United States has, again, in terms of reaching its overall limits, you know, in the fact that to this day, the largest trading partner in terms of goods and services for the Ukraine is Russia. Okay, Russia is like, again, Russia has the same relationship towards Ukraine as the United States has towards Canada. And so the idea that the IMF and the European Union can impose their own principles of austerity based on this long, close relationship between Ukraine and Russia sort of highlights the failure of the policies that our empire has. Because basically, it's like trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. I mean, we can try to dictate, you know, the conditions on the ground to Ukraine all we want. But unless, you know, the United States is willing to go to World War III in confronting the Russians in terms of who should actually be the dominant person for controlling Ukrainian society, it's not going to work. And so once again, you know, the United States is basically, and the European allies are sort of helpless in terms of actually being able to get what they want to achieve in Ukraine. But they're wedded to this ideology. Well, Russian aggression in Ukraine is bad, and American military assistance to Ukraine is good. Well, you know, not even the realists in Washington, D.C. accept that. They say, this is not something is going to wash. This is not going to work, and you'd be crazy to do this if you tried. And so what we have with the Washington, D.C. policies towards the Ukraine now is sort of like we're caught between a rock and a hard place. Our hard place is we'd really like to inject our magical thinking into this area of the world and to control this as just another little puppet state in the great financial ecosystem. But realistically, it doesn't work. It isn't going to fly. Same thing happens with Syria. You know, it's like, okay, why can't we turn the country of Syria into the state of Connecticut? Well, you know what? That is never going to happen, okay? And so, you know, who is in a better position of responsibility to influence decisions in Syria? Is it Russia that has a naval base there? Or is it America and our allies that are literally feeding Al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria to fight the ISIS, which, of course, we sort of helped to create in the beginning? You know, I mean, the bottom line in this thing, in terms of Syria and in terms of Ukraine, is that Vladimir Putin is 100% right in his analysis of the situation. And the Washington, D.C. policy establishment is 100% wrong. You know, Putin kept the United States out of war. Remember the nerve gas incident when we were going to send ground troops to Syria to get rid of those nasty nerve gas things? Putin finessed the situation so we didn't have to commit ground troops. And now here we are again, okay, where Putin is actually saying, I want to be a partner in your fight, America and Europe, against ISIS. Why? Because ISIS is a national security threat much more to the country of Russia than it is to the United States or even Europe. Because that would, you know, the Caucasus and Chechnya and those places in Russia would be the first places where ISIS will go to after maybe it gets through in Syria. So, but yet the United States cannot allow the Russian government to be a full partner in terms of having a foreign policy program in Syria, because somehow we're still caught in this Cold War mentality.
Well, it's not, and beyond that, I think you're right. That's one of the underlying assumptions in the thinking of the people that I think Obama is honestly trying to resist to some extent, not as strongly as most of us would like who understand the situation. But there is a real conflict here because the basic conflict is this. The U.S. government continues to insist it needs to take down Assad. However, they claim the only reason they're involved military right now is because they need to fight ISIS. But they won't cooperate with Iran, and they won't cooperate with Syria, and now they won't cooperate with Russia, who are all trying to fight ISIS. Instead, they continue to consider Turkey and Saudi Arabia allies, even though they are the primary funders of ISIS and enablers. So the hypocrisy is absolutely staggering. I mean, it's on a scale of hypocrisy that beyond anything the people who control the United States foreign policy ever tried to pull over our eyes before since they killed Kennedy.
I think this demonstrates the real severe contradictions right now in American empire and American foreign policy thinking. Because, you know, a huge component of Washington, D.C. people who really know the areas say, look, you know, okay, one of my favorite experts in terms of the current situation in Ukraine is Henry Kissinger, the well-known war criminal. It's like, well, people don't want to deal with Kissinger because, you know, well, whatever, Nixon, Cambodia, you know, guy belongs in The Hague in an orange jumpsuit. But what Kissinger proposes, okay, for Ukraine is that Ukraine needs to be in the same status as Finland was in the old Soviet Union. I mean, Finland was a neutral power that had to deal both with the West and its giant neighbor on the East, okay? And therefore, Finland was never totally in the Western orbit. And the only reasonable way of accommodating both a Russian impulses and American impulses is to make Ukraine a buffer zone, a neutral area. Well, you know, in terms of Syria, it's actually more complicated. Because what we have done collectively,
Carl, I got to tell you, it is more complicated, and we're down to about 30 seconds. So you're going to have to wrap this up quickly.
Well, I think that the fact of the matter is that sooner or later, the United States is going to have to come to the realization that Russia is right, and the major problem domestically is to how to mollify, you know, the forces of reaction in the United States government to get to that realistic position that we should be cooperative rather than confrontative with Vladimir Putin.
Well, that's a good way to summarize it, and I couldn't agree more. And that means we, the people, have to stand up with the people of Russia, Syria, Iran, and the rest of the world that aspire to be free and resist this one world government, this one world corporate government, the new world order. That people like to laugh at when you use the term, but actually it's pretty obvious what they're talking about. Anyway, Carl, thank you so much for being on the show again. I'm sure we'll have you back again soon. That's it this week for Taking Back America. Please join us next week.